From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
I guess my reaction to all the noise about, he wants to go to war is, first of all, I don't understand the tactics, and I guess I would say it's political.
Is the Bush administration planning to attack Iran? A new article in Vanity Fair says the neocons who pushed for the Iraq war are using the same tactics to push for the bombing of Iran. And we'll look at how the corporate media is trumpeting anonymous claims of threats from Iran, much like the anonymous claims of Saddam Hussein's WMDs and the run-up to the invasion of Iraq. Then at a town hall meeting in New Hampshire, Hillary Clinton is asked to acknowledge she made a mistake in voting for the Iraq war.
And the reason I ask personally is because I, and I think a lot of other Democratic primary voters, until we hear you say that, we're not going to hear all these other great things you're saying.
Well, I have said, and I will repeat it, that knowing what I know now, I would never have voted for it.
We'll go to New Hampshire to speak with the resident who grilled Clinton on the war. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. North Korea has agreed to freeze the reactor at the heart of its nuclear program and allow international inspections in exchange for more than $300 million in fuel aid. The agreement was reached earlier today in Beijing after a week of six-nation talks. The deal marks the first concrete plan for disarmament in more than 3 years of negotiations. North Korea agreed to a similar deal in 1994, but eventually reneged on its promise. In Lebanon, three people have died. 20 were wounded after a pair of bus bombings in a largely Christian area outside Beirut. Today's attack comes a day before the second anniversary of the assassination of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafiq al-Hariri. New questions are being raised over the Bush administration's claims that the Iranian government is sending sophisticated roadside bombs into Iraq. On Monday, General Peter Pace, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said he's seen no evidence of any links between explosives killing Americans and top Iranian officials.
We know that the explosively formed projectiles are manufactured in Iran. What I would not say is that the Iranian government, per se, knows about this. It is clear that Iranians are involved, and it's clear that materials from Iran are involved. But I would not say, based on what I know, that the Iranian government clearly knows or is complicit.
Meanwhile, an Israeli cabinet minister is warning Israel might decide on its own to confront Iran in order to halt its alleged nuclear weapons program. Strategic Affairs Minister Avigdor Lieberman said, quote, Israel cannot remain with its arms folded, waiting patiently for Iran to develop non-conventional weapons. At the United Nations, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Mohammed al-Baradei, warned against any such action.
I don't see a military solution to the Iranian issue. First of all, as far as we know, what Iran has now, today, is the knowledge. We do not know that Iran have an industrial capacity to enrich uranium. We do not know, we haven't seen indication or concrete proof of a nuclear weapon program. So I don't see, when people talk about a military solution, I don't know what they mean by that. You cannot bomb knowledge, as I said before. I think it also would be completely counterproductive, in my view.
On Capitol Hill, the House is beginning a marathon three-day debate today on a non-binding resolution opposing the escalation of the Iraq war. The resolution says Congress will continue to support and protect the U.S. troops in Iraq, but disapproves of Bush's move to deploy more troops. Republican critics said the resolution weakens U.S. troop morale. In Vermont, state legislators are voting on its own Iraq war resolution. Vermont could become the first state in the nation to pass a legislative resolution calling for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. In news from Iraq, at least 139 people were reported killed across the country on Monday. Earlier today, 16 people died in a suicide bomb attack in central Baghdad. The blast occurred outside a food warehouse used to distribute subsidized food rations. Also Monday, the Iraqi tribunal sentenced the country's former vice president, Taha Yassin Ramadan, to death by hanging. Syria has imposed new restrictions that could prevent many Iraqi refugees from entering Syria. Syria had been the last Arab country welcoming large numbers of Iraqi refugees. On Monday, more than 5,000 Iraqis lined up in Damascus to register with the UN Refugee Agency. Iraqis fear Syria could order a mass deportation of refugees living in the country illegally. Since the war began, an estimated 1.8 million refugees have fled Iraq. The United Nations estimates up to 50,000 Iraqis continue to flee the country each month. But now the refugees have dwindling options of where to go. In political news, Democratic presidential candidate Senator Barack Obama has suggested he would increase the Pentagon's budget if elected president. Obama made the comment during a campaign stop in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. He said that because the Iraq War has depleted our military, quote, there's probably going to be a bump under an Obama presidency in initial spending just to get back to where we were. The former commander of U.S. forces in Afghanistan says the U.S. still has no intelligence on the whereabouts of al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden. The official Lieutenant General Carl Eikenberry told CNN, quote, the intelligence has gone cold on Osama bin Laden. His comments came as Defense Secretary Robert Gates was visiting the region. On Monday, Gates met with Pakistani President General Pervez Musharraf. Gates vowed U.S. troops would remain in Afghanistan indefinitely.
After the Soviets left, the United States made a mistake. We neglected Afghanistan, and extremism took control of that country. And the United States paid a price for that on September 11th, 2001. We won't make that mistake again.
The Pentagon is reportedly planning a spring offensive against the Taliban. Meanwhile, in Pakistan, four vehicles were damaged on Monday after a bomb exploded at the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross. No one was hurt. Attorneys for Jose Padilla have asked a federal judge to put off a hearing for Friday to determine whether their client is competent to stand trial. Padilla's lawyers say he's suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, complicated by the neuropsychiatric effects of prolonged isolation. The Bush administration jailed him without charge after initially accusing him of plotting a dirty bomb attack. The Bush administration held Padilla in extreme isolation without almost any human contact for about 1,300 days in a Navy brig in South Carolina. He was denied seeing an attorney for 21 months. His lawyers say interrogators used hooding, stress positions, assaults, threats of imminent execution, and the administration of truth serums. When Padilla left his cell, guards covered his ears with sound-canceling headphones. His eyes were covered, blacked out, with blacked-out goggles. One staff member at the brig told attorneys Padilla's temperament became so docile and inactive that his behavior was like that of, quote, a piece of furniture. The U.S. Bureau of Prisons ruled last week Padilla is fit to stand trial. Britain's Attorney General Lord Peter Goldsmith has renewed his call for the Bush administration to close Guantanamo. He criticized the new rules for military trials at the base. He said, quote, the changes made are too little and too late. In news from Africa, the president of Guinea has declared martial law in an attempt to squash a series of popular protests against his rule. He has ordered the army to take all necessary measures to restore order. A nationwide curfew has been in place, and residents are now only allowed to leave their homes for 4 hours a day. In addition, demonstrations, marches, and protest meetings have been prohibited. For the past month, the Guinean government has violently crushed the union-led protest movement. At least 100 demonstrators have been killed. Palestinian officials are urging the international community to lift economic sanctions following last week's power-sharing agreement between Hamas and Fatah. This is Palestinian Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh.
I say to the quartet and to the European Union and others that this is the will of the Palestinian people, and they should respect it and respect this agreement. And they should work to end the status of siege that the Palestinian people have suffered for a long time.
Meanwhile, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas is preparing to meet with Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert and U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice in Jerusalem next week. According to the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, Olmert is refusing to discuss several major issues, including the status of Palestinian refugees, the status of Jerusalem, and the possibility of an Israeli withdrawal to pre-1967 lines. In Salt Lake City, a gunman shot and killed five people at the Trolley Square Shopping Center. Police have not yet identified the gunman, who was shot dead by city police. Meanwhile, an armed man in Philadelphia opened fire during a company board meeting yesterday and killed three men. He then shot himself. A major new scientific study on medical marijuana has just been released. The study found AIDS patients suffering from debilitating nerve pain got as much or more relief by smoking marijuana as they would typically get from prescription drugs and with fewer side effects. The study appears in the journal Neurology. And over 50 peace activists are going on trial Wednesday on charges stemming from their arrest on Capitol Hill last September while protesting the Iraq War. The protests were organized by the National Campaign for Nonviolent Resistance. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. New allegations against Iran are heightening fears the Bush administration's planning a second war in the Persian Gulf. This weekend, administration and military officials accused the Iranian government of sending sophisticated roadside bombs to Iraq that have killed 170 coalition troops in the last 3 years. Military officials formally unveiled the charges at an unusual news conference in Baghdad. The officials refused to be quoted by name and barred all recording devices from the room. Reporters were shown images of weapons with serial numbers the Pentagon says originate in Iran. The Iranian government's denying the accusations. On Monday, President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was asked by ABC's Diane Sawyer whether Iran is sending weapons into Iraq to kill Americans.
When it comes to Iraq, we have made it clear that insecurity in Iraq is also to our disadvantage and also a disadvantage of the nations of the region. And we will be sad to see people get killed, no matter who they are.
The Americans have the pictures. They have rocket-propelled grenade launchers that have Iranian serial numbers on them, and that they go back to 2006.
I think that Americans have made a mistake in Iraq, and unfortunately, they are losing, and this is a shame for Americans, of course, and that's why they are trying to point their fingers to other people. And pointing fingers to others will not solve the problem.
Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad speaking to ABC's Diane Sawyer. Meanwhile, the top U.S. military commander, General Peter Pace, added to growing doubts about the accusations Monday when he admitted he could not endorse them.
We know that the explosively formed projectiles are manufactured in Iran. What I would not say is that the Iranian government, per se, knows about this. It is clear that Iranians are involved, and it's clear that materials from Iran are involved. But I would not say, based on what I know, that the Iranian government clearly knows or is complicit.
General Peter Pace speaking in Australia. The Bush administration's insisting the new allegations do not signify a buildup towards war. In an interview with C-SPAN Monday, President Bush defended the White House pressure on Iran and mocked speculation of a possible U.S. attack.
This is typical Washington, where people are out speculating. And I do think it makes sense to make it clear to the Iranians through the international community that they're isolating themselves, and we'll continue to press hard to do so. I guess my reaction to all the noise about, he wants to go to war is, first of all, I don't understand the tactics, and I guess I would say it's political.
Amid these new developments, a new article in Vanity Fair magazine says the behind-the-scenes maneuvering that led to the Iraq War is being repeated today. The article says, quote, once again, neocon ideologues have been flogging questionable intelligence about WMD. Once again, dubious Middle East exile groups are making the rounds in Washington, this time urging regime change in Syria and Iran. Once again, heroic new exile leaders are promising freedom. The article is called From the Wonderful Folks Who Brought You Iraq. Craig Unger is the author of the piece, joins me here in the Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks for having me.
So lay out who is pushing for this, the history of this, Craig.
Well, you can certainly trace it back at least 10 years to 1996, when Benjamin Netanyahu had just been elected Prime Minister of Israel, came to the United States. He met with an Israeli-American think tank with Richard Perle and some of his colleagues. And then they put together a paper called A Clean Break, which outlined a radical new vision of democracy for the Middle East. And this called for war with Iraq, for overturning Saddam, regime change with Saddam Hussein. 2 days later, Netanyahu made a speech before a joint session of the United States Congress, and he added another country to the list, which was Iran.
And where did it go from there? That's 1996.
Well, in 1999, actually, Richard Perle started meeting with then-candidate George Bush. And this has really not been reported much at all, but he came away with that meeting saying that Bush had agreed that if he were to be president, he would help overthrow Saddam. So that to me is the first time I know that Bush got seemed to have signed off on that. If you talk to the neocons today, a lot of them will say, well, yes, it's a mess in Iraq, but that's because we've just begun. We haven't really started. This should be a regional war, that Iran is the real focus.
Can you talk about the meetings between neoconservatives and Iranian exile groups?
Well, you have two important people who've shown up. One is Farid Ghadri, who is a Syrian. He may be, so far as I know, he's the only Syrian exile who's a member of AIPAC, the right-wing Israeli lobby. He actually sent out mass emails. He's been compared to Ahmad Chalabi so often that he actually sent out a mass email that was headlined, "I am not the new Ahmad Chalabi." Reza Pahlavi, the son of the Shah of Iran, has also been put forth as a potential leader of Iran.
Can you talk about the people then who were pushing for Iran, then going on to push for Iraq, now much discredited, how they have the power today?
Right. Well, I think if you go back to November, it looked like President Bush was really on the ropes in terms of this policy. The Democrats had just won both sessions of Congress. Just after the election, Rumsfeld was sort of thrown overboard. And in the meantime, you also had the Iraq Study Group with James Baker, who was a very close friend of the president's family. And he was putting forth a bipartisan solution that really acknowledged that Bush's Iraq policy was a failure, and that it was time to start cutting our losses. In the meantime, however, Vice President Cheney seemed to be keeping a very, very low profile. And it's useful to remember that his wife, Lynn, is at the American Enterprise Institute. And they suddenly came up with a new policy paper called Choosing Victory, written by Frederick Kagan. And General Jack Keane contributed to it as well. And this was the policy for a surge. So it ended up becoming a rival policy to the Iraq Study Group, and that's what Bush chose.
Can you talk about the Institute for Advanced Strategic Political Studies?
Well, this is where Richard Perle and Mayrav Wurmser, who I interviewed, and her husband, David, who is now head of Middle East policy for Dick Cheney, and they put together this policy, A Clean Break. The term A Clean Break meant a clean break from the Land for Peace formula that was being used to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian dispute. And this was a real radical departure. If you go all the way back to the 1967 Six-Day War with Israel in the Middle East, Israel had won enormous amounts of territory. Their policy then was to start trading it for peace, a Land for Peace formula, and President Carter in 1978 managed to get Sadat of Egypt and Prime Minister Begin of Israel to sign the Camp David Accords, which has lasted for nearly 30 years now. The rest of that formula, though, has been much, much more difficult to implement, and the neoconservatives decided to discard that in favor of a completely new vision that was far more radical and meant a sweeping overhaul of the Middle East.
Greg Unger, can you talk about MEK and the neocon links to this group? What is it?
Well, it does seem like a horrible replay of the events leading up to Iraq in many ways. The MEK is a Mujahideen-e-Khalq, and it's a terrorist group, really, that worked for Saddam Hussein. When the United States invaded Iraq, we captured many of these people and started using them to do covert operations inside Iran. And we have gotten intelligence from them. Once again, it seems a replay in the sense that in the way that the neoconservatives used Ahmad Chalabi and the Iraqi National Congress with the Iraq War, it looks like they're trying to do the same thing all over again. And once again, the intelligence seems to be rather dubious.
You talk about how Richard Perle was the guest speaker at a fundraiser sponsored by the MEK, though he later claimed he had not been aware of the connection.
That's what he says, at least, yes. I'm not so sure I believe him on that.
Well, explain how that happens.
Well, there was a front group backing it, and I guess he's making the case. He did not respond to my calls, but he had made the case that he was unaware that it was the money for this event was going to the MEK. Other members of the other neoconservative policymakers, such as Raymond Tanter, have come out very much in favor of using the MEK.
And explain who Raymond Tanter is.
He is a neocon policy maker who has suggested using actually tactical nuclear weapons in bombing Iran.
He's with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy.
Right. So here again, you see potential extraordinary escalation of events. When the bottom line is, if you listen to the International Atomic Energy Agency, we just saw a clip of El Baradei saying that there's no real evidence that Iran's nuclear program is actually a nuclear weapons program. And once again, I think you see Iran, like Iraq, trying to have it both ways, bluffing, trying to present themselves as a great regional power by putting forth the notion that they have weapons of mass destruction, but also saying, well, geez, there's no real evidence that we have it when it comes to the United States.
Greg Unger, explain how Zamil Khalilzad fits into this picture. Was it the White House becomes ambassador to Afghanistan, then ambassador to Iraq, and now ambassador to the United Nations?
Right. Well, he goes way back, and if you go to 1991 or 92, I believe, he was in the Defense Department with Dick Cheney, remember, was Secretary of Defense right after right after the Gulf War of 1991. Even before the 1996 clean break policy, in 1991, Cheney was charged with coming up with a new policy for American supremacy. And he had Khalilzad and Paul Wolfowitz were in the Defense Department back then. So this is really the first time you see neocon policymakers come up with a policy, and their paper, it was known as the Defense Policy Guidance Paper, even before a clean break, came up with this vision of radically overhauling the Middle East.
And how central is Khalilzad in all of this?
Well, he's very important. Now he, of course, he's up for being ambassador to the United Nations. He has been ambassador to Iraq, and he was in Afghanistan as well. So he's been a key player all along.
We now know about the Iranian peace offer in May of 2003 that was rejected by the Bush administration. Can you talk about this?
Well, it was sort of known as the grand bargain because it put almost all the issues of the Middle East on the table. That included the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It included Iran's nuclear program. And it included Iran's security issues. Back then, we were in an extraordinarily strong position vis-a-vis Iran. That is, we went into first to Afghanistan and took care of Iran's number two enemy, the Taliban. Then we were just going into Iraq and taking care of their number one enemy. The Bush administration, it seems to me, could have gotten something out of this. This was a point at which the United States had extraordinary leverage over Iran, and in many ways we had shared interests vis-a-vis both Iraq and Afghanistan. Iran had enormous security issues. They're surrounded by nuclear powers, if you think about it. Israel and Pakistan are very close to them. So they had very real security concerns, and it's very tough to trust them. But this was an opening, and we did not even respond to it. In fact, the administration rebuked the Swiss ambassador, Timothy Gilderman, for even bringing up the subject with us.
Why?
The administration policy has been we do not talk to our enemies, and I think that has not kept us in good stead in the Middle East.
We're talking to Craig Unger, journalist and author. His latest piece is in Vanity Fair. It's called From the Wonderful Folks Who Brought You Iraq. We come back, we'll continue our conversation with him, and we'll be joined by Rick MacArthur of Harper's to talk about the latest news on weapons from Iran, or at least the allegations about them. Stay with us. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The new accusations of Iranian-supplied bombs in Iraq first appeared in Saturday's New York Times. The article was headlined, "Deadliest Bomb in Iraq is Made by Iran," U.S. says. Some media critics immediately compared the New York Times piece to its articles on Saddam Hussein's alleged weapons program that were used by the Bush administration to make the case for invading Iraq. These critics have pointed out two similar features between Saturday's article and those before the war: a near-complete reliance on unnamed government sources, and the byline of New York Times reporter Michael R. Gordon. Gordon and former New York Times reporter Judith Miller co-authored the infamous September 8, 2002 piece alleging Iraq attempted to purchase aluminum tubes towards developing nuclear weapons. The New York Times later singled out the article as part of its editor's note apologizing for its inaccurate coverage of Iraq and WMDs. Well, Michael Gordon appeared on Democracy Now! Last March. During our interview, I asked him about his reporting in the lead-up to the U.S. invasion of Iraq.
There was no agency in the American government that said Saddam was not involved in WMD. You know, the State Department, although it's turned out to be correct, certainly on the nuclear issue, did not turn out to be, you know, didn't challenge the biological case, the chemical case. And I'm going to offer you this last thought, and I'm happy to respond to any questions you have. But, you know, there are a number of complicated WMD issues.
Let me just ask something on that. Are you sorry you did the piece? Are you sorry that this piece?
No, I'm not. I mean, I don't know if you understand how journalism works, but the way journalism works is you write what you know, and what you know at the time you try to convey as best you can, but then you don't stop reporting.
Well,
can I answer your question since you asked me a question?
Well, no, I wanted to
get... No, wait
a
second. If you ask me a question, I'm happy to answer all your questions, but what I'm trying to explain to you is one thing. That was what I knew at the time. It's true that it was the key judgment. It's the same information they presented to Colin Powell, by the way, and it's what persuaded him to go to the United Nations and make the case on the nuclear tubes. I wrote the contrary case, giving the IAEA equal time. They disputed it. I don't have a dog in this fight. I didn't know what was the ultimate truth. When the IAEA came out in January and disputed it,
I reported
it.
Let me just respond. We have limited time in the program.
Well, then you should let me answer your question.
But I did. And
no, you haven't let me answer your
question. Are you sorry, then, that the New York Times was sorry that this piece appeared as it did on the front page of the New York Times?
I don't think sorry is the word the New York Times used.
Well, let me...
That was the New York Times reporter Michael Gordon speaking on Democracy Now! Last March. I'm joined in the studio now by Rick MacArthur, publisher of Harper's Magazine, author of the book Second Front, Censorship and Propaganda in the Gulf War, as well as by Craig Unger, who has this new piece in Vanity Fair called From the Wonderful Folks Who Brought You Iraq. Rick MacArthur, your response to the New York Times piece and then pieces, the news conference in Baghdad that people couldn't bring in their cameras.
I always read the New York Times the way Sovietologists used to read Izvestia, the government newspaper. And I half-kiddingly always ask the question, is the New York Times playing the role of Izvestia or the role of Pravda, which was the party newspaper? The New York Times owes its success, its long-term success, economic and otherwise, to being close to the government, to being sort of the semi-official government newspaper and giving the administration line to the public fairly unfiltered. And Michael Gordon is just a tool. He's just a conduit for this policy that the paper has been pursuing for decades. So what's interesting about Michael Gordon is that when he did the reporting on the phony aluminum tube story with Judith Miller 4 years ago, he somehow escaped unharmed and is now thriving. He has a book out, as you saw, and
right.
He's doing very well, and he's going around acting like he's an expert on Iraq, when in fact he's still playing the role of conduit for the official line, the army line, or the government line, depending on who he's talking to on what day. Now, what's interesting is the play that they gave the story on Saturday, the Michael Gordon story about the exploding canisters, or whatever they're calling them. The canisters are called EFPs. They put it on the top of the front page, and it was the lead story, actually, in the Saturday paper. And not far down in the story, you find a paragraph. Actually, this was in the Monday story. You find a paragraph where they say, and this is very interesting, that they don't have any real evidence, any direct evidence that any of this is true. All they have is the say-so of the military briefers or the national security briefers. There's one who's unnamed, who's clearly been brought in from the civil side of the government to help buttress the case. Well, if they don't have direct evidence, why is it on the front page? Why is it the lead story? Just to give you a comparison, Newsday, perfectly respectable newspaper, puts U.S. Iran, Iran is arming Shia on page 22 on Monday, that is yesterday. They do a story. They report what the military officials are claiming. But in the second paragraph, they say the military command in Baghdad denied, however, that any newly smuggled Iranian weapons were behind the five crashes of U.S. military helicopters since January 20th, four confirmed as having been shot down by insurgent gunfire. So that is what journalism is, contrary to what Michael Gordon says. It's putting the story in perspective, pointing out that the guerrilla movement, whatever you want to call it, in Iraq is broad-based. It's dominated by Sunni, not by Shia. And the most damning omission in the story, if you want to talk about overall perspective, is complete lack of perspective on who's fighting whom, who's shooting at whom in Iraq. Does the Iranian government really have an interest in destabilizing what's now a Shiite-dominated government? Doesn't make any sense. If it does make sense to the administration that the Iranians want to destabilize a Shiite-dominated government when they're a Shiite-ruled nation, then they should explain it. But there's no logic to it, and there's just this massive omission.
It's interesting, when the New York Times did that piece, September 8th, 2002, talking about, well, allegations of weapons of mass destruction, Judith Miller, and as well as Michael Gordon. The day that that piece appeared, Vice President Cheney was on the Sunday morning talk shows. She was holding the New York Times, so you don't have to believe me.
Right.
It's here in the New York Times.
Right.
So one confirms the other. And, of course, their article is based on unnamed sources, of course, in the Bush administration. You have this press conference on Sunday in Baghdad. Saturday is the opening salvo with the New York Times, once again, front page piece with Michael Gordon. But it's not just Michael Gordon who writes the piece and he tapes it to the front page of the Times. It's the entire institution, because the editors decide to put it on the front page.
Right.
Now, they've already done their, what some call their mea culpa, what I call their kinda culpa, on their Iraq coverage. So what do you think is going on here?
Well, today they ran a story on the front page, at the bottom of the front page, quoting critics, quoting skeptics, saying that maybe there isn't much to this story. And then, of course, you ran the clip of the general saying that
Peter Pace
saying, or the chief of staff saying, we don't have any direct evidence that the Iranian government is behind this. It might be Iranians, but we don't know that the Iranian government is behind it. So what's going on is the New York Times, again, the publisher of the New York Times, Arthur Sulzberger Jr., trying to keep his newspaper where it's been historically, which is close to the government as a spokesman or a semi-official spokesman for the government. I always call it the Government Gazette. And journalism that Mr. Gordon talks about is left to other lesser mortals like you and me and my colleague here, Mr. Unger, because that requires actually thinking before you just repeat the stuff that's given to you by the high official sources. Now, I'm sure they're also very nervous right now that they're going to get it wrong, which is why they ran the story on the front page today, trying to cover themselves. But their record is so bad now on getting the story straight that I don't know why anybody would read the New York Times anymore for straight news. What people are doing now is they're reading Paul Krugman's column. Krugman had a very good column yesterday sort of picking apart the case that the institutional paper is making for Iranian meddling in Iraq and asking all the questions that Gordon should have asked or that James Glanz, the other reporter, should have asked in his story yesterday. But including the pertinent fact that there were no cell phones or cameras or anything allowed at this big security briefing in Baghdad.
And the rationale for that?
The rationale for that is that the Times is covering itself more broadly now. My question to Paul Krugman would be, are we at the point now where a columnist for the New York Times, and not even a journalist, is going to blow the whistle on the newspaper, on the institution that he works for? Because at this point, it's such a blatant violation of what's correct in journalism that a columnist needs to comment on it, that Krugman or Bob Herbert or somebody has to take his own newspaper to task on this. I don't know if they've got the wherewithal or the guts to do it, but somebody's got to do it.
Craig Unger, you've been working on this piece that you did in Vanity Fair for many months from the wonderful folks who brought you Iraq, looking at the same neocon ideologues behind the Iraq war, have been using the same tactics, alliances with shady exiles, dubious intelligence on WMD to push for the bombing of Iran. As President Bush ups the pressure on Tehran, is he planning to double his Middle East bet? And then this all explodes this weekend as your piece comes out. Did this surprise you?
No, in fact, it was very much in line with the narrative that I'd started. And I would just add to all this, if this really was about who was killing Americans there, the vast, vast majority of American deaths in Iraq have been in the Sunni-dominated areas. So the real question should be, where are they getting their weapons from? But what you see that has happened is that our policy has had extraordinary unintended consequences. We have inadvertently tilted towards the Shiites and empowered Iran. Now we seem to be tilting back towards the Sunnis. And you see this Sunni-Shiite civil war within Iraq potentially spreading throughout the entire region. So we don't want to alienate our Sunni allies like Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Jordan, who may be helping the Sunni insurgency.
Well, they most definitely are helping the Sunni insurgency. I mean, I can't give you a document that shows that Saudi money is going directly to the Sunni insurgents, but it's a very, very good bet. Just as it was a very good bet before 9/11 that the Saudis were funding the Islamic fundamentalist charitable organizations that helped cover for the 9/11 hijackers. But they get special treatment because the Bush family is friends with the Saudi oligarchy and with the Gulf oil Arabs and the Persian Gulf oil oligarchies. And so the New York Times follows their lead. You don't see stories in the New York Times speculating about Saudi Saudi grants of money going or through the back door going to fund the Sunni insurgency. At least I haven't seen any. Maybe you've seen some.
No.
Yeah.
You begin your book, Second Front, talking about Saudi Arabia being the ones to decide what press gets to cover. That was the Gulf War.
Right.
But maybe you could repeat that, because here we are many years later, more than a decade later, and that part of the story, the key role of the media in the telling of all of this.
Right. Well, this is, of course, part of what my book is about, what is what Mr. Unger's book is about almost entirely, is that the Bush family, when they decided it was time to move against Saddam Hussein, their former ally, for getting too greedy, for taking too much oil from Kuwait or trying to take the whole thing over, as April Glaspie, remember, April Glaspie said we didn't think he was going to take the whole thing.
The former U.S. ambassador to Iraq.
So when the Bushes make policy, they talk to, at that point it was King Fahd, and now it's King,
Abdullah.
And they say, well, we would like to have a presence in the Middle East. We'd like to have troops in Saudi Arabia, but we need permission from our loyal allies. And so they come up with a case for a threatened invasion, an imminent invasion from Kuwait by Saddam into Saudi Arabia, which was a pretext completely unsupported by documentary evidence. But they make the case, and they send the troops to Saudi Arabia. And then, it's a wonderful irony about freedom of the press in this country, they assign to Prince Bandar, a member of the royal family and then the very influential Saudi ambassador to Washington, the role of deciding who gets credentials in the U.S. press to go to Saudi Arabia to cover the buildup. And I have this scene at the beginning of the book where the Washington bureau chiefs of the major networks, ABC, NBC, CBS, and CNN, go to Bandar's house on Chainbridge Road in McLean, Virginia, and they basically kiss his pinky ring and beg him for credentials. So it's a Saudi monarch or aristocrat deciding what the American press gets to cover, and that sort of sets the tone for the rest of the Gulf War coverage. And it brings us to this it's not funny. It brings us to this absolutely nearly disastrous end.
By the way, AP reported in December private Saudis supplying money for arms to Sunnis, including anti-aircraft arms.
I urge people to read other newspapers and to read the Associated Press. The Associated Press, which I used to make fun of, I'll admit, as a former UPI man, has become the alternative source of information in the United States, along with the BBC and a couple of British papers. The AP is gotten very good. And if you just read a straight Associated Press story on any of these stories, Iraq, Iranian meddling, alleged Iranian meddling in the in Iraq and so on and so forth, you would get a straighter story, a better understanding of what's going on than you would get from the New York Times.
Well, Craig Unger, I'll give you the last word, since your book was called House of Bush, House of Saud, The Secret Relationship Between the World's Two Most Powerful Dynasties.
Well, I think the scary thing is, will this happen again? Will we repeat history? I mean, it's hard to forget events that just happened 3 years ago. If it happens again with Iran, it's been a catastrophe in Iraq. If it happens again with Iran, I think the consequences are much, much greater potentially. That is, you can see Iran easily blockading the Straits of Hormuz in the Persian Gulf, which would cut off about 40% of the oil in the world. And oil prices would go up to at least $125 a barrel. That could precipitate sort of a meltdown of the whole Western economy and almost a global oil war. Iran is very close to China in terms of it. China's the biggest customer there. You effectively would have a war going on in three of the world's biggest oil-producing countries, Iran, Iraq, and potentially Saudi Arabia.
Well, we're going to leave it there. I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Craig Unger, his piece is in Vanity Fair from the wonderful folks who brought you Iraq. And Rick MacArthur, publisher of Harper's Magazine, author of Second Front, Censorship and Propaganda in the Gulf War. Thank you both. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Back in a minute. Muslim Gauze here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As Democratic presidential contenders campaign across the nation, the war in Iraq continues to weigh on the minds of potential voters. Over the weekend, Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton had to face difficult questions from concerned residents in New Hampshire about her authorization of the Iraq War. During a town hall meeting on Saturday in Berlin, New Hampshire, Roger Tilton, who drove 3 hours from Nashua to see the senator in person, asked her a question.
I want to know if right here, right now, once and for all, without nuance, you can say that that war authorization vote was a mistake. And the reason I want to ask is because a lot of other senators have already done so, including some Republicans and including one of your competitors, Senator Edwards. And the reason I ask personally is because I, and I think a lot of other Democratic primary voters, until we hear you say that, we're not going to hear all these other great things you're saying.
Well, I have said, and I will repeat it, that knowing what I know now, I would never have voted for it. But I also, and I mean, obviously you have to weigh everything as you make your decisions. I have taken responsibility for my vote. The mistakes were made by this president, who misled this country and this Congress into a war that should not have been waged.
New York Senator and presidential hopeful Hillary Clinton speaking Saturday in New Hampshire, answering question from an audience member, Roger Tilton, who joins us now live from Manchester, New Hampshire. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Roger. It's good to have you with us. Well, why don't you lay out the scene and how you came to ask this question, and were you satisfied with her response?
Well, the scene was Berlin, New Hampshire, up near the Canadian border. I think she chose Berlin because it's been hard hit by mill closings, a lot of jobs lost. I did get up at 4 a.m. and I did drive 3 hours. I got there about 7:30. The event started at 8:30, and I was looking for a restaurant to have breakfast, and I couldn't find one, and that told me a lot about Berlin. It looked like all the old restaurants had been boarded up. A lot of the businesses had been boarded up. There were a lot of holes in the ground where buildings used to stand. And I found a Dunkin' Donuts, and I asked the shift supervisor, what's going on here? And she told me about the mill closures and the jobs lost and the people moving out. So that kind of sets the scene. We met at the Berlin City Hall. About 300 people were there, and it was a very festive, joyful atmosphere. It was Senator Clinton's first visit to New Hampshire, and I wanted to be at this historic first visit by a female presidential candidate. I have two daughters who now both want to be president, so I wanted to be there, and I wanted to just to experience it, and it was going very well. It was very cordial, jovial. Everybody was happy. And then I asked that question, and the mood changed pretty rapidly.
And how did you come up with this question? Is this something that you have wanted to ask her for a long time?
No, actually, I came up with the question while I was sitting there listening to all the other questions. I thought, you know, this is going really well for Senator Clinton. I'm just going to ask her a really easy question. I'm going to ask it in a very slow and deliberate tone so she gets it. So that, you know, just once and for all and without nuance, she can say either yes, it was a mistake, or no, it wasn't. But you're talking to me on Tuesday, and that was Saturday, so obviously it wasn't the right answer.
How do you feel about her answer? What do you feel was lacking?
Well, she didn't answer the question, and she nuanced it. You know, to say that if I'd have known then what I know now is a cop-out, that's a political answer. That's not an answer to the question. I think there was a pundit on one of the Sunday talk shows that says, yeah, if we knew then what we know now, we never would have gone to war. You know, that's not a good answer. It's just not a satisfying answer. It's almost as though she went into her political file and found the right note card and leaned in and glared at me and gave me the answer on the note card. It wasn't a genuine answer by any means.
Have you gotten a lot of response from the press after asking this question?
Well, the joys of having a listed phone number, I guess. Fox News especially was hounding me all weekend to appear on one of their programs. I got calls from all the major networks except NBC. So I'd say, yeah, it's been pretty overwhelming. The other thing is a lot of my friends from around the country have either seen an article in the newspaper, heard me on your show yesterday, seen me on television over the weekend. So my phone's been ringing off the hook.
And are you going to be questioning Barack Obama? He just came to New Hampshire. He spoke last night.
Yeah, unfortunately, I was not able to get out to his public rally in Durham. But I do plan to talk to him. I plan to question as many of the candidates as I can. I think that's one of the real joys and benefits of being a voter in New Hampshire, is that we actually get to walk up to these people and ask them questions that either are not being asked by the media or that the candidates refuse to answer when asked by the media, but for some reason they just can't refuse to answer the voters.
Well, Roger Tilton, I want to thank you for being with us as we turn now to another New Hampshire voter. Hillary Clinton has also said she would not rule out attacking Iran. She spoke earlier this month at a dinner organized by AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee here in New York.
The regime's pro-terrorist, anti-American, anti-Israeli rhetoric only underscores the urgency of our response to the threat we face. U.S. policy must be clear and unequivocal. We cannot, we should not, we must not permit Iran to build or acquire nuclear weapons. And in dealing with this threat, as I have said for a very long time, no option can be taken off the table. But Iran is a threat not only because of the hateful rhetoric spewed by its president, not only because of its nuclear ambitions, but because it uses its influence and its revenues in the region to support terrorist elements that are attacking innocent Israelis, and now we believe attacking American soldiers.
Senator Hillary Clinton speaking February 1st at a dinner organized by AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. Ann Miller is the director of New Hampshire Peace Action, also joining us from Manchester. Welcome to Democracy Now, Ann.
Oh, thank you. Good morning.
Talk about your involvement now with these town hall meetings of Senator Clinton, of Barack Obama.
Yep. Over the weekend, Senator Clinton spoke in Berlin, Concord, and Keene. And there were members of our community who were attending, obviously, all of those events. I went to hear Senator Clinton speak in Concord and was not called on during the meeting, but afterwards approached the senator and asked her about the comments that she had made at the AIPAC meeting earlier in the week, and asked her if she really would leave all options on the table, and how could she threaten, in effect, other countries' children with nuclear genocide. She looked me right in the eye and she said, "No options are off the table. We cannot abide by a nuclear-armed Iran. It would be an existential threat to the United States." And what I found really interesting in that comment and that use of the word existential is that isn't a word that's used very much in U.S. political discourse, but it is used in Israel's political discourse. And that's of deep concern to me, that we have a Democratic presidential candidate who is a militarist of this nature, and that she isn't coming out and saying we need strong diplomatic action with Iran, which is really the only answer. There are no military solutions with respect to Iran that I can see.
You visited Iran last year?
Yeah, I was in Iran in 2005 and spoke with many citizens from Tehran, from Esfahan and Yazd, and was absolutely impressed by their intelligence and about how much they know about the West, and how curious they are about the West and about our culture. And they came running. I mean, I was one after another in Tehran. It was really like being a bit of a rock star, where they come up and ask if you have a Yahoo email account, can we stay in contact with you? They want their borders open. They want to have economic opportunities.
Ann
and
Miller,
so many of the young people in that country.
Before we get to the end of the broadcast, I wanted to ask you about Senator Barack Obama, who made a stopover in New Hampshire Monday, one day after Hillary Clinton campaigned there. It was Obama's first trip to the influential primary state as an official Democratic presidential candidate. He entered the race Saturday in his home state of Illinois. He spoke at an evening rally at the University of New Hampshire. Obama addressed the issue of Iraq.
And we understand that in Iraq, the only way to solve that bloodshed that's taking place right now is to arrive at a political accommodation. There is not a military solution to that sectarian civil war. And we need to start a phased redeployment to start bringing our troops home. We know those things.
Ann Miller, you got to question Barack Obama?
Yep, I talked with Barack Obama yesterday afternoon in Concord, actually. He stopped in at a deli, the Eagle Square Deli in Concord, and asked him, actually, to vote against the supplemental funding even before we sort of look towards more of his presidential aspirations, because if he says he's against this war, which he says he is, he needs to make his vote count in the Senate and defund it. And he did bring up the legislation that he has introduced calling for the redeployment of U.S. troops by March 2008, which is an improvement over other candidates, but at the same time, he needs to be voting against the supplemental funding in the Senate.
And what did he answer you?
Where he currently is. He said that he is not sure he's going to do that. He says that he thinks that legislation has a better shot of passing in the Senate at this point. But again, I would side with Senator Russ Feingold, who says if you're against this war, you have to stop funding it.
Ann Miller, we have to leave it there.
I suggested to the senator.
Director of New Hampshire Peace Action. That does it for today's broadcast. DemocracyNow.org is our website. We have a TV producer job opening. Check our website. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.